Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Mathematics is everywhere in our modern world. Sometimes it's obvious and sometimes not, but there's no denying that it's here to stay. At times, it can be confusing and overwhelming, but our guest today, Timothy Revel, is willing to take the fight to mathematics for the sake of us all. In his book, Man vs. Math, Tim has faced up to mathematics mano a mano, tackling game theory, probability, cryptography, and more, exploring how these subjects relate to everything we see around us. Hello, and welcome, Tim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, welcome to the show. And a little later, we're going to be making some primitive encrypted messages. And to do that along with us, you're going to need two pencils, and preferably the hexagonal ones, six-sided, and you'll see why later, a sheet of paper, and a pair of scissors. So we'll look forward to that later. But to fire up the grey matter, first, Miriam, today's producer, has a cryptographic-themed puzzle for you guys. Hello, Miriam, what have you got for us?
Good morning, everyone. So today's brain teaser is a bit of a long story, but stay tuned and listen to the story, and hopefully you'll find out the answer to this brain teaser. So I want to send a message to a friend in the post, but the postal service is notoriously corrupt and will not read any messages sent unless it is in a locked box. I have access to a large number of locked boxes and padlocks, as does my friend, but we each only have the keys to unlock our own padlocks. If the boxes can have any number of padlocks on and we can send only boxes and not keys to one another, how do we send a message securely? So maybe I'll repeat that just one more time. So I want to send a message to a friend in the post, but the postal service is notoriously corrupt and won't read any messages sent unless it is in a locked box. I have access to a large number of lockable boxes and padlocks, as does my friend, but we each only have the keys to unlock our own padlocks. If the boxes can have any number of padlocks on and we can send only boxes and not keys to one another, how do we send a message securely? So message us or tweet us in at Science Mixtape. Hopefully you have the answer.
Yeah, a bit of a long one today, but hopefully it'll be quite interesting. While you ponder that mystery, let's have our first song. Tim, you've chosen The Golden Age by the Asteroids Galaxy Tour. Why did you choose this?
I think it's a really good place to start. I think it's a really good song for a Saturday morning. It's got a bit dancey, it's a bit poppy. But I've also got a real fascination with Denmark because my girlfriend's Danish and so are the Asteroid Galaxy Tour. So this is like my introduction to Danish music.
Algorithms are the computer processes and formulas that take your questions and turn them into answers. Google makes changes to its algorithm roughly 500 times per year.
Wow. So algorithms and Google changes them quite a lot. Tim, in your book, you talk about finding out algorithms for matchmaking, finding love. Can what we look for in a person just be boiled down to a few numbers?
Well, there's certainly things that a lot of matchmaking sites can do to try and pair people together in sort of more precise ways. So three of the questions that are often come up in these sort of matchmaking sites is sort of, you know, the original question, do you like sci-fi? Something like that. Then how would you like a partner to answer? Do you want your partner to be into sci-fi or not? And these things aren't always obvious. So if it's a question like, are you a chatty person? Maybe you want someone who doesn't chat that much because you like to talk a lot, or maybe you want someone who doesn't like to talk, who does like to talk. Like, yeah, exactly. These things can be sort of different ranges of importance. So the third question that people normally ask is, how important is that answer for you? So maybe if your partner says no to sci-fi, but you're a big sci-fi buff, that doesn't matter because your best friend's into sci-fi, so you don't need that from your partner. So by sort of answering these sorts of three types of questions, you can then sort of combine them mathematically and output a score for your compatibility between you and a potential match. And that's how a lot of these matchmaking sites that try and get you on personality work.
And so when did dating sites actually start using these algorithms? Like, was it straight off the bat? Because I assume that there was probably sites that were just lists of people, like newspapers.
Yeah, so I mean, there's been attempts to matchmake people for a long, long time. Like, my favorite example comes from the 1960s with a guy called Jeffrey Tarr, who was at Harvard University, and he decided to make his own matchmaking service. And this was way before the internet or decent computing was available to everyone. So instead, you had to fill out a questionnaire, send it to him in the post along with $3, and then he would turn this into a sort of punch card system that ran through a massive IBM computer. And then out came your pairing, and he would then send you back a number of a person to call who you would go on a date with. And obviously this was really expensive and not very good, so it didn't last very long. But since then, there've been, you know, particularly with the internet, there've been a lot of matchmaking sites that have come up, and over the years they've slowly tried to refine their techniques to make them a bit more objective and mathematical, with the idea that hopefully that'll lead to better matches.
Right, so what can we learn, like, from them? Does it tell you about how people find love? Or?
Well, to an extent, yes. I mean, one of the websites that sort of really claims to use mathematics in its algorithms is one called OkCupid. And sometimes they put out sort of blog posts analyzing the data that they've collected from people who've been matched together. And the sort of the way they tell whether it's a successful match is if those people have then gone on to have a conversation. And one of the interesting things they found is that you sort of rank someone's attractiveness on OkCupid on a scale of 1 to 5. And one might think that the sort of higher your score is, the more likely you are to get a date.
Yeah, but you're more attractive and people want to go out with you, right?
Yeah, exactly. But it turns out that average attractiveness is really not a good measure of this. So if you find someone who's, the example they use is someone who's got an average attractiveness score of 3.5 versus someone who's got an average attractiveness score of 3.4. So the person with 3.5, you'd expect to get more dates, but in this case, it doesn't happen because the person who has the average attractiveness score of 3.4 is way more controversial. This person gets a lot of ones and a lot of twos, but also a lot of fours and fives. And it turns out those fours and fives are what turn you into being someone who gets a lot of dates.
Right, so the average isn't really a good representation because there are some people who like you a lot and those are the people who are going to message you, but there's a lot of people who don't like you very much, and so it drags your average down.
Absolutely, so you should really embrace it. Like, the haters are going to hate, but in terms of getting dates, it's the lovers that you want, right? The people who think that your strange tattoos or your odd-shaped glasses or maybe you've got a weird face, those are the people who will go on a date with you. So you should really sort of jazz them up and embellish them and show them off.
That's really reassuring for all those weird-faced people out there. It's interesting. I was wondering if you think that these algorithms actually kind of codify the way that we look for relationships, or is it just like a measure of something and it's not really how we're actually looking?
I think when you look at the evidence, it seems that dating websites are really no more successful at matching people long-term than the old-fashioned methods like meeting someone in a pub. But I think what they do well is they sort of codify the things we think we want in a relationship. And I think that's why it's so difficult to get these correctly. You know, when you're answering these questions, you say what you think you want in a partner, but we all know love works in funny ways. And when you meet someone in a pub, maybe they're nothing like the person you imagined, and then you stay with them for the rest of your life. And I think it's really hard to capture that on a website or a questionnaire or an algorithm. Maybe one day we were able to do it. It's not necessarily that it's impossible, but we need to be able to understand sort of the way humans work a little bit better before we'll be able to do that.
Yeah, and so talking about in the future, there are other, you know, that at the moment machine learning is a kind of big buzzword, and this is where you tell a computer to try and essentially, I'm going to try and, you know, explain it in a very simplistic way, is that you give a computer the task of finding connections between things, but you don't tell them how to find the connections. You just kind of let the computer sift through the data and it finds its own connections. Does this have applications to kind of matchmaking algorithms? Is it going to make them better, or have people not really looked into that?
I think in principle, it would be really interesting to see machine learning applied to matchmaking, but there aren't any of the big companies who are actually actively advertising this yet. And I wonder if part of this is people a little bit uncomfortable by the idea of just a machine sort of looking at all your information and learning the sort of person you would be interested in. But I think, yeah, in principle, many of these machine learning algorithms can be incredibly perceptive and show up interesting results. So it would be interesting to see someone do this. And I suspect there are quite a few people working on it, but we haven't yet seen the sort of drop of that product yet.
Yes, a lot of these algorithms are actually proprietary. Like, they don't actually share them with people because they make a lot of money by putting people together, even if it's for one date. And so I guess the other thing that algorithms are really being used with on the internet at the moment is things like algorithms for news sites like Facebook. And that, you know, this has led to a bit of controversy with Facebook using an algorithm a couple of years ago, did it not?
Yeah, there was a sort of famous study in 2014 where Facebook took 700,000 people, so it wasn't a small study, who were all using Facebook, and they split them into three groups. In one group, they showed people fewer status updates that had happy words in. In the other group, they showed people fewer status updates with sad words in. And in the third group, it was just a control, so nothing changed. And then over the course of a few months, they collected millions of status updates from the people who were in the study to see whether anything changed, whether they were more likely to post happy things or sad things, or whether nothing changed at all. And it turns out that, yeah, if you see less happy posts, you're less likely to post a happy post yourself. And the same goes true for sad posts. When you see less sad posts, you post less sad posts yourself. And so part of the reason why this was controversial is because, for a start, it's sort of like mood control. Facebook is able to control your mood to an extent, which is a sort of uncomfortable idea that some, you know, conglomerate in the US can control your mood sitting in Soho Radio.
That's amazing.
That's weird. But they also never told anyone about it. So if you were in this study, you didn't know. So that also adds an extra element.
That raises some ethical questions about, is this study okay? Because they haven't asked for prior approval. Normally, when people do psychological studies like this, they have to get approval to that they're not going to hurt anyone or damage anyone.
Yeah, so Facebook's argument for this is that their algorithm isn't just a straight UC news items based on date order. You get so many every day that it wouldn't be possible to keep up. So instead, they try and prioritize the things you're most likely to see. So they're constantly tweaking these algorithms all the time. So they sort of say, well, we don't need to get anyone's permission to tweak them again. It's in the terms and conditions. Right. But when you change from sort of whether you would like to see this post to whether it will make you happy, I think a lot of people went, this is maybe a different issue that we should have a better conversation about.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's my concern would be if these algorithms could then be used to influence people, they could be done for specific subjects, you know, things like elections or, you know, the promotion of certain people in a positive light could then lead to people voting for one and not the other. So that gets into all sorts of murky grounds.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really, really hot topic, especially with the most recent US election. I mean, one thing that did happen on Facebook was they had these things called targeting adverts. And these are, I mean, this isn't changing status updates, but this is a case of having so specific advertising to different people. And it's something like 50,000 variations of a single advert was able to be put across the website. So you could imagine one party saying one thing to one group of people and saying something completely contradictory to the other. And this is really like, oh, this, we're really in strange ground here now, because we've known for a long time that many politicians don't always tell the truth, but now they can sort of do it on a scale that was unprecedented before.
And obviously we have advertising laws to protect us from this sort of thing, but there may be, you know, laws are delayed to the advancements in technology, something like Facebook, where they have a huge amount of computing power and can do this and can modify adverts to target specific people. Maybe it's going to take a bit of time before the law catches up. I mean, at the moment, the algorithms do have some human input, though, right?
Yeah, so there are parts. So like, as I said, there's many different components that decide what's top of your news feed. And at the moment, much of the tweaking of these algorithms, the knobs that turn that decide which goes to the top, are done by humans. But actually, once that's done, most of it is left to the algorithm to decide on, you know, for most people. And then humans step in if something is reported as, you know, being offensive or
fake
something.
News.
Yeah, well, fake news is that there isn't a particularly good mechanism for reporting something like that. Yeah. So that's something Facebook have said they're trying to work on now. But it's really hard to judge what is fake news and when should it be removed from a news feed. And should Facebook be the people who decide truth? All of these things are really difficult things to decide. So it's a really complicated problem.
When is it fake news and when is it just satire? And it's obviously well,
exactly.
Fake, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, well, let's move on to your next song. You've chosen The Zombies, Time of the Season. Any particular reason?
Yeah, the reason why this is one of my favourites because it's in the film Awakenings with Robin Williams, which is about the medical professor Oliver Sacks. And it's just such a great film. And the point in the film when this comes in is really interesting. But just to give a quick, what's the film about? It's about it's a true story. And it's about patients who are catatonic. So they can hardly sort of move or interact. And they get given this sort of new revolutionary drug, which is called L-Dopa, which we now use for Parkinson's. And over a summer, many of them wake up and become their former selves. And as that happens, they play this song.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in the sun to promised lands to show you everyone. It's the time of the season for.
A cipher is an algorithm that is performed on individual or small chunks of letters. For example, the Caesar cipher is where a letter in the alphabet is mapped to a different letter. So A equals D, B equals E, C equals F, and so on.
Yeah, so we're actually going to try and do make our own little ciphers here. And so I said to get hold of two pencils and a sheet of paper and a pair of scissors. And what you're going to need to do is take the sheet of paper and along one edge, cut a strip that's about the width of the pencil and kind of cut that off. So you've got a nice, long, thin strip of paper. So we're actually going to try and do that in the studio here. So, Tim, if you want to take up your strip and wrap it around your pencil. Oh. So if you use this this hexagonal one, and the reason I'm saying you're going to use the hexagonal one is because what you're going to do is wrap the paper around the pencil so that it kind of spirals along it. And so you're only putting one layer of paper across the pencil. And we're going to tweet a picture of this so you can kind of see what's happening as we go along. And then what you're going to do is you're going to take your other pencil. And if you look on the piece of paper, there should be one little kind of square that's on a flat edge of that pencil. And then you can write your message with one letter on each of those little squares on one piece of paper on the facet of the pencil. And what happens is you'll then write your message in lines across and then rotate the pencil around a little bit and see if you can write a whole message. And so I'm just going to spend 2 seconds doing that now. And okay, I'm done. And so then, after I've written my message, I'm going to unravel the piece of paper. And if you've written a complete message all the way around, you end up with a string of letters when you read down that just looks like absolute gobbledygook. And mine has got a little bit of a few spaces in it because I didn't manage to get all the way around the pencil. But now what you can do is I can send this piece of paper to someone else, which I give it to Tim here.
Oh, thanks.
And he's got the same size pencil. And if he wraps his message round, and if you wrap it, actually, I think it will go the other way.
So, like this bit.
And if he wraps that piece of paper around the pencil, he can then reread the message. And this is something called a skittily, actually. And it was used as long ago as the 7th century by the ancient Greeks. And what they would do is they would have two pieces of wood, each with a number of flat sides on it. and both of them would be exactly the same size. And then they take a strip of leather or something similar and wrap it around that block of wood, and then give and then write the message across on the leather strap, just as we've done on our pieces of paper and our pencil. And what that means is you could then just send that piece of paper, and your message can only be decoded when you add it onto the piece of wood. So let's see if Tim can work out what I've horribly scribbled.
Well, you know, I think the writing is the hardest bit to get from your cipher, because I can definitely see the first word is Kyle. I mean, that's like really clear.
Yeah.
And then maybe is a, and then what you are, I can't really tell.
Well, you're close. It's Kyle is saying hi.
Oh, he's saying hi.
Yeah. So
now you say that, I can see that.
So what kind of cipher is this? How does this work? Or do we still use things like this?
No, we don't use ciphers like this anymore, not unless you're sort of sending messages as for fun between people. But yeah, the trick with many ciphers is that you've got to take a message written down normally, turn it into gobbledygook in a way that the person you're sending it to can turn it back into the original text. So this is like a transposition cipher, so you're using some sort of physical means to move something around. But yeah, the real trick is that when you unravel this piece of paper, if you don't know how to use this particular cipher, you're never going to work out what that message actually says.
Yeah, so I mean, when you have this little strip, it's kind of obvious how you're going to recombine it. You have to wrap it around something, those folds in the paper. But if I was to take the gobbledygook and then write that out onto a new piece of paper and then send you the piece of paper, and you'd have to rewrite the cipher onto a strip in order to decode it, then you've got a bit more, it's a bit more secure, and that's kind of more about what an actual cipher is.
Yeah, so the real thing with this particular cipher is that you need to know how to decode it. But the problem with this cipher, which is sort of alluding to your first problem that you announced at the top of the problem, is that anyone else who knows how to decode the cipher can also decode it. So if someone intercepts your mail along the way, you're then in trouble, because if they know how to do this particular cipher and they've got a pencil and a strip of paper, they can find out your message.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about cryptography in a minute, but we're going to have your third song, which is London Grammar and Hey Now. Why this one?
I think it's just it's really representative of the album, to be honest. It's one of my favourite albums, and they've got a new one coming out soon, which I'm really looking forward to, and this is one of my favourite tracks off the last one.
Burning by my bed for you here now. I can feel my instincts here for you here now. By my bed for you here now. Here now.
Cryptography is the practice and study of hiding information. It's used in bank cards, computer passwords, and online shopping.
Well, it's used in quite a lot, actually. We had our basic cipher a little bit before, but now we've now moved on to much more complicated encryption. How is it used today?
Yeah, so, I mean, as you said just then, it's used in so many different places. Basically, anyone who uses a smartphone or the internet or a computer is using encryption every day, probably hundreds, if not thousands of times. And the real trick is it's all about sending information that you don't want someone else to get access to. So that might be, as you say, like a bank information. It could be just your personal messages. You don't want your neighbor sniffing on the messages you're sending to your girlfriend or something. I mean,
to your other girlfriend.
Yeah, well, exactly. Those things are really important. So it has moved on quite a lot now, and it's the basis of all cryptography. It comes down to mathematics, and it's about finding a sort of complicated way of jumbling text up that is really difficult to de-jumble.
So what kind of mathematics do people use for encryption?
So in encryption, the main trick is you need something that's really hard to do in one direction, but much easier in the other. So what you want to be able to do is that for anyone who wants to send you a message, you want them to be able to encrypt it, jumble it up in an easy way, but you want decrypting it, de-jumbling it, putting it back into normal text to be really, really hard, so that only you can do it because you know a special key or a secret method or something like that.
Right, so it's almost like there are too many ways to do it the other way. So
you want
to have to try lots of different attempts, and then it takes too long for it to decode.
Exactly. So the piece of math that we actually use for that in a lot of cryptography is something called prime factorization. So it involves prime numbers. So if you don't remember from school, a prime number is a number that is divisible by one in itself. So 7 can only be divided by 1 in itself, but 9 can be divided by 3. So it's not a prime number. And so every single number is a multiple of prime numbers. So if you take 21, for example, this is 3, which is a prime number, multiplied by 7. And it's really easy to multiply two numbers together, 3 times 7, that's an easy process. But going the other way, going from 21 to working out its prime factorization, is harder. But when you get to trillions of digits, it becomes really, really hard, to the extent that if you had a computer to try and do this, it could take to the end of the universe to compute such a problem. So we use that piece of maths to encrypt.
So in order to try and find out the prime factors of a number, you have to do lots of divisions. You have to kind of take that number and say, well, is it divisible by 3? Because then if it is, then 3 is one of the prime factors. But there's no obvious way of just knowing what numbers are the prime factors. You just have to do the division.
You have to do trial and error. And the thing is, the way that they make this so difficult is by multiplying together two massive prime numbers. Because so this prime factorization is unique. There's only one set of prime numbers that make up any number. So you have to try every single number up to this massive prime number before you reduce the number that you're trying to find the prime factors of.
Right.
So it takes a very, very long time, is the idea.
So does that make things truly uncrackable?
Well, it's an interesting question, because in principle, with a standard computer and a big enough sort of key using this type of encryption, it's basically uncrackable, providing you've put everything in place properly. But it turns out that with quantum computers, maybe these sorts of encryptions are much more easy to break. The sorts of algorithms that would be able to find prime factorizations are far more efficient. So people are already working on how to come up with encryption methods that wouldn't be breakable by a quantum computer.
I think they've managed to use a quantum computer to factorize a number, but the biggest number they've managed to factorize is 15.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually gone up recently, but that's still not very many. It's not hundreds of digits long.
Yeah, we're still a long way from that, but it's an interesting problem, because what could be happening now is I could be storing everything you ever send from your computer, knowing that when I get a quantum computer in 20 years' time, I can decrypt it then.
Right.
So we're sort of already broken. If we assume that quantum computers are going to be available one day, our encryption today could just crack everything that's ever been written. But maybe in 20 years you don't mind what was sent, or your bank details are no longer relevant. But it is sort of an interesting state that we're in, that we know it's going to be broken at some point, and that means it's a problem right now.
Right. And so without actually cracking it, they've heard recently about backdoors and encryption. There's this big thing between the FBI and Apple trying to make them put in. What is a backdoor? Does that inherently make the encryption less secure?
Yeah, it does. So, I mean, a backdoor is, the metaphor is a good one. It's a sort of way that, an extra way in which you can crack the encryption that is sort of unrelated to the specifics of the way people are communicating. So the idea is that, it's sort of like having a master key for a padlock, that you might know the specific way that you have to turn the combinations to open that lock, but someone's got a key that can do that for every single padlock. And the problem with that is, maybe you want the right person to be able to do it, the police to get into the phone of someone who's committed a crime, but by having a backdoor, someone else can discover it at some point. So it does weaken it for everyone. It's a balance about whether that's what we want with encryption.
But it doesn't matter, right? Because quantum computers mean it's broken anyway.
So absolutely. We're screwed either way.
Okay, so let's on that happy note, let's have your next song. This is Shaq and Undecided.
Thank you.
The oldest encryption attempt known to mankind dates back to the Kingdom of Egypt, around 2000 BC.
News.
World's first synthetic receptor switches it up.
First ever underwater sighting of a true beaked whale.
NASA's new budget.
Corn on the cob is no longer a killer.
Do I need 8 glasses of water a day?
Oh yes, 8 glasses of water. Let's talk about that. I've always been told you need to drink all the time, 2 liters or whatever. Do you actually?
So there's actually no actual evidence that you actually need 8 glasses of water a day. So that's really strange because we're always told to have 8 glasses of water. So I was really like surprised when I found out about this. So a physiologist from Dartmouth Medical School in New Hampshire tried to find the evidence for actually having 8 glasses of water, and he couldn't find it. The only mention of it was a 1974 book that casually advised 6 to 8 drinks a day, and that included things like soft drinks, coffee, tea, milk, and even beer. So there's no actual evidence that you actually need 8 glasses of water a day.
I could do 8 beers a day. That would be fine. I probably wouldn't be able to function, but that's kind of obvious. And I always just thought you needed it, but it just comes from nowhere.
Yeah. No,
well, some science is rubbish, eh? But we've discovered a new whale.
Yeah, well, so we knew...
How did you miss a whale?
We knew the whale existed before, but we've never managed to film it underwater. So there's been sightings and there's been some sort of dead ones beached on the sand, but we've never actually seen one underwater until there were some teachers and their students who happened to spot this whale whilst they were on a boat trip in the Azores, and they jumped in with a GoPro and filmed the thing and later found out that it was this really elusive whale.
Wow, that's I'm still bemused. But so apparently they miss them because they spend a lot of time underwater, right?
Yeah, they dive down to about 3 kilometers and spend hours at a time down there, only to come up for a couple of minutes to breathe again. So we don't see them very often. But they have my favorite thing about the true beaked whale is that they have this incredible adaptation, which is essentially pockets for their flippers. So they have these little, I mean, it's so cute. I mean, these things are like 5 meters long, but it's still cute. They have like these little folds in their sides where they can put their flippers. That means they're really streamlined when they move through the water. So they're really good at getting down to deep depths.
I love it. That's so good. So I was reading about the world's first synthetic receptor. So this is researchers at the Universities of Bristol and Manchester have created a synthetic receptor. So a receptor, chemicals and structures in cells that they allow communication between the cell and the outside of the cell. And so it's how cells communicate with each other through things like hormones. And what these researchers did is they built a molecule that has a head which has a binding site on it, which something else can attach to. And then there's a long linker which tunnels through a membrane, and on the other end is connected to a fluorophore, which is something that emits light if it's in one state but not in another. And what they're able to do is when the head's exposed to a particular molecule, it communicates that change to the fluorophore and then it starts emitting light. And this is a completely synthetic molecule, and which is amazing because what they've managed to do is make a version of the molecules in our cells that do these amazingly complicated things. And it can actually lead to a better understanding of those mechanisms and maybe even fix problems which develop with those communications. So you can design a new molecule which could in some way like replace or even bypass the ones that exist in our cells. So this is like a really big advance being able to fix a lot of problems that we have in biology by actually building our own replacement on a cellular level, which is amazing.
Sounds like that would be the ultimate body hack, replacing your cells with synthetic ones.
Yeah, exactly. So, Merrim, there's been some new money going into NASA, right? They've released a new budget. What mm-hmm. what are they going to do?
So NASA has a new budget of about $19.5 billion, and they want to spend it on sending humans to Mars. How cool is that? So by 2033, maybe we'll be seeing humans on Mars. So Congress actually encourages NASA to keep working on its space launch system and the Orion capsule, so that they think that this is the most practical approach to reaching Mars and getting people on there. So not only do they want humans on Mars, but they also want to search for signs of life on Mars too.
Oh, wow. That's really good. Going to Mars. Well, in our lifetime, people, maybe even in our lifetime.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Well, Elon Musk from SpaceX wants to do it in 2 years' time. So,
oh,
wait. I mean, it's a crazy ambition, but...
Hey, they landed a rocket, you know, recently. Maybe they can get to Mars. Who knows?
Yeah, he wants Mars and the moon in the next 2 years.
Wow.
Ambitious. I mean,
that's ambitious, but
it's ambitious,
if he can make it, then, you know, props to him. So I was actually reading one more thing, which was that corn on the cob is no longer a killer. I know that you thought that it, you know, was a killer before, but don't worry, we're now safe. And actually, this is a thing where the universities at the University of scientists at the University of Arizona have found a way to make corn resistant to a fungus called the Aspergillus fungus. And they've kind of done this in a novel way, that what the fungus does is it infects the corn and it produces a toxin called aflatoxin, which is deadly to humans, and it makes the corn basically inedible. But what they've managed to do is splice genes into the corn so that the corn itself produces this RNA molecule that shuts down the production of the toxin in the fungus. So the plants still get infected, they still have the fungus, but they no longer produce this chemical, which is dangerous to humans. And this isn't really a problem in kind of the West or like in the US where they grow a lot of corn, because they can test for the presence of this toxin. And once the level of the toxin gets to 1 in 20 billion, they just destroy the crop. But in other parts of the world where they're not able to test for the toxin, they just consume it anyway. And it's been related to stunting growth in children, and it makes people more susceptible to diseases like malaria and HIV. So this new corn is actually resistant to disease, where it still allows its infection, but doesn't produce the toxins that are deadly to humans. So, or deadly, but dangerous. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. I thought that was a brilliant little advancement.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting part of sort of genetic modification that we can make stuff better. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether that then gets the approval to go and actually be used in countries where it's important.
Yeah, so it's still in stages. It still needs to go into field tests and various things like that, but it's looking promising. Right, so that's our science news. So let's have your next song, Tim.
What is my next song?
Oh, next song is Kate Bush, and you've chosen Sat in Your Lap. Why did you choose that?
Oh, yeah. Partly, I mean, I love Kate Bush. She has such amazing songs, and this is one of my favourite. And if you've never seen the video, I urge you to go and watch it now, because she just does the most incredible dancing that you will want to use for the rest of your life.
Well, wait 15 minutes till the show's over, but then, I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
Go and watch
or have it whilst the radio's on. You can listen to our version
muted,
whilst having the video on.
Encryption is the most practical and easy way to protect electronically stored, processed, or transmitted data.
Yeah, so we're relying on encryption still. Tim, I know you have written this book, Man vs. Max. I know that you had a history in studying both mathematics and computer science. How did you get into writing from that?
I think it was during my PhD. I sort of did a maths undergraduate and masters, and then went and did a PhD in computer science. And throughout that, I met a group of people who were putting together a science magazine, and I wrote a little bit, and then I wrote a little bit more, and then I just couldn't stop writing and talking on the radio and doing all sorts of, you know, what we call science communication and journalism. And from there, I just sort of realized by the end of my PhD, I'm not one of these people who hated being a researcher or any of that stuff, but that the thing that was really getting me up in the morning was the chance to learn new stuff and write about it and tell people about it. And
so
that's where I went
more.
In.
Yeah,
I liked that more than the sort of daily grind of sort of advancing your tiny little piece. I'm not sure, I might go back into that one day, but I think, you know, an opportunity came up to write a book, and I'd always sort of wanted to do that. And then off the back of that, I got a job in proper journalism at New Scientist.
Oh, so you're working at New Scientist at the moment?
Yeah, that's right. I'm now their sort of tech physics maths reporter. So,
and so how did you choose the subject for the book? Is that something you'd always wanted to write about, or did you just kind of look around for a while?
There had been a lot of maths topics I'd wanted to write about, but what I really wanted to do was, a lot of popular maths books are really about, you know, sort of old-fashioned maths, you know, your Pythagoras's and your Newtons, and anything from the last 400 years sort of gets forgotten, but actually there's more maths going on now than ever before, and so I wanted to sort of highlight some of that stuff. And a lot of this is possible with computers, you know, a lot of the maths that is really incredible now couldn't be done without massive computing power. So like one of the stories we tell right at the top of the book is about this mathematician who was able to find a 19th century ship that had been filled with gold, sunk, and completely lost. And he used a combination of fantastic mathematics and the sort of computers that came available in the sort of late 80s to be able to find this ship. And it's just an incredible story that sort of gets forgotten, you know, that maths was at the heart of that. And so we're sort of able to tell that. And I mean, that's one of the chapters, and there's many more stories like that in the book.
So maths can make you rich. You know, you can find hidden treasure even.
Well, it's an interesting story. So, like, the guy who financed the thing, he sort of took all of the money, and then all of his backers said, "Where have you gone?" And he disappeared, and he's then been on the run for 20 years. So it's like, it can make some people rich, but you've got to be quick.
Brilliant. So I think we're going to have a little look at the puzzle that we proposed at the top of the show. Mm. So, Miriam, why don't you remind us what it was, and then we'll see if we can figure it out.
Okay, so just as a reminder, the brain teaser was, "I want to send a message to a friend in the post, but the postal service is notoriously corrupt and will not read any messages sent unless it is in a locked box. I have access to a large number of lockable boxes and padlocks, as does my friend, but we each only have the keys to unlock our own padlocks. If the boxes can have any number of padlocks on them, and we can send only boxes and not keys to one another, how do we send a message securely?"
So, and I feel like we've stumped quite a lot of people. Mm-hmm. We haven't had as many responses as we normally do for people coming in and trying to check. Did you work it out, Tim, or did you know?
Well, so I do know this problem, but I'm not surprised people were stumped. Like, this is a problem that people struggled to be able to do for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years until the sort of late 60s, where we finally worked out the answer to this problem.
We gave you an hour.
Yeah, well, you had an hour. So.
Well, okay. So how do you do it? What's the answer?
So you send a box with a padlock to your friend. He puts his own padlock on the package and sends it back. Then you take off your padlock and repost it back to your friend. Then he takes off the padlock, and then he can read the message.
All right. So this sending back, you have to relock and send back before you can take it off. That's
tough one,
I have to say. So Tim, thanks so much for joining us. And how can people get in touch with you and learn a little bit more about what you've done and read more about?
So they can find me on Twitter at Timothy Revel. They can have a look on my website, where I always post the things I've been writing, timothyrevel.com. Or they can purchase my book if they like, which is available in all good bookstores and Amazon. And it's a quick search for Man versus Maths will have it come up.
Brilliant. And so you've been listening to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. And if you want to listen again to any of our previous shows, they're all available on Mixcloud as well as iTunes and most other podcast providers. So get in touch on Facebook or tweet at Science Mixtape if you enjoyed something particularly in the show. And we're going to finish up with Tim's final choice, which is Villagers and Nothing Arrived. So thanks for joining me, Tim. And why did you choose this final song?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been really great. I think they're one of my favorite bands, and his voice is just unmistakable, and I think this is a great example of just how great a singer he is.